Beneath the headlines, behind the timelines, there is a story no one wants you to find. Welcome to Some Unapproved Thinking, where forgotten truths, buried patterns, and invisible systems rise to the surface. You weren't crazy. You were just early. Let's begin.
You're sitting with a biography of Howard Hughes, the billionaire who secretly built the CIA's most expensive ship. And somewhere between page 200 and page 300, you realize nobody actually tells you how he got away with it. Not the eccentric billionaire version, the real version, the one that proves the system protecting him in 1960 didn't die, it just evolved. It became Jeffrey Epstein. It became something we're still not allowed to see clearly. This is Some Unapproved Thinking.
Thank you to our sponsor, the Dark Horse Entrepreneur Podcast. Unlock your potential with the Dark Horse Entrepreneur AI Escape Plan, the podcast empowering hardworking parents to break free from the 9-to-5 grind through AI-powered side hustles. Check them out at darkhorseentrepreneur.com. Now back to the show.
Here's what they want you to know. Howard Hughes was a visionary, an oddball genius, spruce goose. TWA Hollywood producer. The kind of weird rich that makes billionaires seem like independent rebels. That's the acceptable narrative. That's what keeps you from asking the dangerous question. What if Hughes wasn't an anomaly? What if he was a template? In 1946, Hughes bought RKO Studios. He was 41. He had unlimited capital. He had military contracts. And he had something else, something nobody talks about in the sanitized versions. He had access, direct access to senators, generals, CIA operatives, and judges who needed things the government couldn't officially want. This wasn't nepotism. This was infrastructure. This was a system where a man with enough money and the right connections could exist in a space between law and immunity, between visible and invisible. The files declassified in the 1970s, the Church Committee investigations revealed CIA assassination plots, domestic surveillance programs, and MKUltra. What they didn't fully expose was the depth of private sector entanglement. Hughes's name surfaces in relation to CIA plots against Castro, but that's where the documentation thins. That's where it always thins. Because once you start pulling that thread, you're not reading about one eccentric billionaire anymore. You're reading about a mechanism, a proof of concept. The man pulling that thread had a name, Robert Mahieu, former FBI, CIA contract agent, and the chief executive running Hughes's Las Vegas operations starting in the late 1950s. Mahieu testified before that same church committee. He admitted his role in CIA mafia plots to assassinate Fidel Castro, coordinating with organized crime on behalf of the agency while simultaneously running Hughes's Nevada empire. Mahieu was Hughes's shadow. He was also the CIA's. That's not a metaphor. That's the documented record. One man sitting at the intersection of private capital, organized crime, and federal intelligence. That's what institutional capture actually looks like. Here's what makes Hughes the actual prototype. He understood something fundamental that Jeffrey Epstein would later weaponize. Institutional capture isn't about breaking the system. It's about becoming too useful to prosecute. Hughes needed the government. The government needed Hughes. Defense contracts, intelligence operations, cover companies. By the 1950s, Hughes Aircraft was producing classified missile systems. He wasn't just doing business with the Pentagon. He was the Pentagon's private contractor. He was doing work senators couldn't vote on. Work that existed in classified budgets, black budgets. And Hughes Aircraft's profits flowed into the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, a tax structure Hughes built in 1953 that shielded his company from congressional oversight while keeping him in personal control. Institutional Immunity Incorporated. The clearest proof of that immunity came in the early 1970s. Hughes provided the cover story for Project Azorian, a classified CIA operation to raise a sunken Soviet submarine from the floor of the Pacific Ocean. The vehicle was the Hughes Glomar Explorer, a custom-built deep-sea vessel. The cover story was that a private citizen was conducting commercial deep-sea mining. The actual budget was $800 million in government funds. When thieves broke into Hughes's Summa Corporation headquarters at 7000 Romaine Street in Hollywood in 1974 and stole documents that exposed the operation, the CIA, FBI, and LAPD coordinated to suppress and recover them. That coordination between a federal intelligence agency, federal law enforcement, and local police to protect a private citizen's files is the level of institutional protection we're discussing. The Glomar files stayed classified for decades longer. The church committee never fully touched them. When you exist in that space, when you're too embedded in national security to touch, other rules become negotiable. Everything becomes negotiable. The women started in the 1950s. Young actresses, studio employees. The RKO connection meant something specific in Hollywood. It meant authority without accountability. He could call you to a screening, he could offer you a contract, and he could make you disappear from the industry if you refused. The predatory mechanics were identical to what Jeffrey Epstein would deploy 60 years later. Same psychological leverage, same institutional cover, same assumption that wealth plus access equals immunity. But Hughes added something Epstein didn't have until much later: government protection. When rumors started circulating in the late 1950s about the young women around Hughes, about the parties, about the girls who looked too young, those rumors died in newspapers before publication. Editors got calls. The calls came from people representing interests that went higher than journalism, higher than law. This is documented in media histories that most people never read. By 1960, Hughes was untouchable. Not because he was careful. He wasn't careful. I mean, let's be honest. He was careful the way a man is careful when he knows the rules don't apply. He was open about his preferences. He was open about his control. He kept records, and those records were protected by something stronger than lawyers. They were protected by institutional silence. Mutual silence. The silence of a system that had decided Hughes was more valuable intact than exposed. His personal handlers, the inner circle that controlled access to him and later ran his Summa Corporation empire, enforced that silence. They were his private security apparatus, his secret police. And when Hughes became too incapacitated to manage his own affairs in his final years, they managed the empire for him with the CIA's quiet approval. The motif here is visibility. Hughes operated in plain sight. Everyone in Hollywood knew. Everyone in Washington knew, and nobody said anything, not because they were paid, though some were, but because speaking would require them to acknowledge that the system they served permitted this, that the system, by definition, protects its own. Jeffrey Epstein understood this architecture exactly. He studied it. He may have learned it from watching Hughes operate for decades. He built his own version in the 1990s and 2000s with one critical difference. He had multiple benefactors instead of one. Les Wexner, the retail billionaire who built the Limited, transferred over $200 million to Epstein and gave him power of attorney over his estate. Wexner's name appeared in FBI emails from 2019 as a potential co-conspirator. Jean-Luc Brunel, who supplied models and ran a network of young women across Europe, was found dead in a Paris prison in 2022. Before he could testify. The network had redundancy. More resilient, more distributed, harder to collapse. Because if you take down one patron, nine others are still invested in the silence. This is what the mega group represented: a documented network of billionaires with intelligence and political connections operating in the same coordinated tier of power that Hughes occupied alone. Here's where the morphology gets specific. Hughes's networks were military intelligence. Epstein's networks were political, judicial, financial. Different nodes, same principle. In both cases, the system didn't fail to protect them because the system wasn't designed to. The system was designed to protect them. Prosecution was never the intended outcome. The outcome was containment until death. Investigation just enough to seem legitimate. Then controlled amnesia. The real mechanism is this. Once you cross a certain threshold of usefulness, once you know state secrets, or once you're connected to people who know state secrets, or once your collapse would expose too many people in power, you're no longer bound by normal law. You're bound by negotiation. Your crimes become classified. Your victims become non-persons in official documentation. Your existence becomes a problem to be managed rather than corrected. Hughes lived this way for 40 years. 40 years. Not in hiding, in the open, on the cover of magazines, discussed in newspapers, and the core of what he was, the predatory architecture, the institutional capture, the immunity, never touched the official record while he lived. It stayed in files, in sealed testimony, in the memories of people who signed non-disclosures. The pattern that connects Hughes to Epstein to the still unnamed networks operating past Epstein's all too convenient death, power structures at a certain level don't prosecute themselves. They reform just enough to survive. They sacrifice the edges and protect the center. They create plausible deniability layers. They ensure that when exposure comes, it's controlled, it's decades late, it's incomplete. So the actual architecture remains classified. Epstein's conviction in 2008 for solicitation of prostitution, a plea deal brokered by then U.S. Attorney Alex Acosta, 14 months, not 20 years. Not a federal investigation into his networks. Not a prosecution of the judges, senators, and intelligence officers named in his black books. A deal, a reset, a negotiation. Acosta later said he'd been told Epstein belonged to intelligence. The visible punishment that allows the invisible structure to continue. When Epstein was arrested again in 2019, the machinery activated differently. The 2008 deal had become a liability. The internet changed the game. Institutional silence was no longer reliable. So the outcome was death in custody. Convenient. Final. No trial. No testimony. No unsealed files. Ghislaine Maxwell was convicted in 2021. The edge was sacrificed, but the names in those black books, the documented co-conspirators, the network that made the operation possible for three decades, the system adapted. The protection mechanism evolved. Different method, same result. The actual network survived. The vulnerable nodes were removed. The declassified files on Hughes are still incomplete 60 years later. Information that would be 80 years old is still behind classification. Why? Because Hughes is dead, but the people who protected him aren't. The institutions that benefited from his existence aren't. The precedent he established that wealth plus institutional utility equals functional immunity, that's still operational. This is the trap. Once you see this pattern clearly, you can't unsee it. You can't look at current billionaires with government contracts the same way. You can't look at intelligence-connected financiers the same way. You can't watch another high-profile arrest and believe the outcome was about justice rather than management. You've been shown the skeleton key. The architecture is obvious now. The question isn't whether it exists. The question is, how many active Epsteins are operating right now in spaces we're not allowed to see? The motif returns, poisoned now. Visibility. Hughes operated in plain sight. Epstein operated in plain sight. The actual mechanism, the reason they weren't stopped, operated in complete darkness. Not because it was hidden, because it was classified. Because the people who would expose it were inside it. Because institutional loyalty trumps moral law at a certain tier of power. The real scandal isn't that Hughes got away with it. It's that the system that protected him is still intact, still operational, still selecting which billionaires remain visible and which ones disappear, still determining which networks get investigated and which ones get protected, and still writing the official history in a way that obscures the actual mechanism. You know how Hughes ended? In a sealed room, drugged, controlled by handlers. His money still moving. His name still useful. His actual crimes never prosecuted. His files never released. He became a ghost while he was still alive. And when he died in 1976, the machinery that used him simply found the next node, the next useful billionaire. the next willing participant in a system that would protect him from the law as long as he remained valuable. The system doesn't need Hughes anymore. It has hundreds of Hughes now, distributed, networked, classified. You're looking at the blueprint within your own lifetime. This has been Some Unapproved Thinking. Tracy, out.
If this story didn't sit right with you, good. You're not here to be comforted. You're here to see what others overlook. Thanks for exploring Some Unapproved Thinking. Learn more at someunapprovedthinking.com. New episodes drop weekly. Subscribe, share, and keep questioning, because the pattern's still playing out, and next time, we're going deeper.